next case for argument is 14-1253. And I'm sure I'm going to butcher this, but it's Breese-Lichtenik.
Breese-Lichtenik.
Okay.
Surgery. I'll just call it Breese.
All right. Versus Langdon.
Mr. Shavey, may it please the court. The district court erred in its claim construction. Under the proper claim construction, there is no infringement. The limitation of Claim 1 requires a sliding means being displaceable on the tubular carrying means. The correct construction of displaceable on means some contact, some budding, engaging. That construction stays true to the claim language and aligns with the patent's description of the invention. Now, why is it?
Where in the record did you ask for that construction?
On the summary judgment motion, Your Honor, Breese had moved for summary judgment of willful infringement. That was denied. That issue came up. We argued legally that displaceable on means contact and engaging. That's where. It's in our opposition. It was a legal argument.
But there was a claim construction that preceded that, and that this term was not in play, right? And that whole claim construction proceeded.
Well, under SenMed case,
Is that right? Am I right about that?
You're right about that, yeah. Because it wasn't in play, but in dependent claim 2, it was the word on was in play, and we agreed.
I'm asking you about the term that you're raising here as a claim construction question. When you went through claim construction below, was this term in play?
Yes, it was. We proposed the claim construction, which the district court adopted, but the term on itself was not in play because on means on in our interpretation.
Well, the claim construction that you proposed does not result in the resolution you're seeking here, right? You're seeking a further claim construction beyond what you originally proposed in your claim construction, right?
Well, I think it's consistent, though, Your Honor. I agree that the word on wasn't disputed when we proposed the term, because it came up on claim construction. Yes, is this a means plus function term? We said yes. The sliding means is an annular structure. Everybody agreed with that. Court and Breese agreed with us. And what was the function? We proposed being displaceable on the tubular carrying means. Everybody agreed with that, too. And the district court, in its claim construction order, adopted that. But I agree that the term on itself was not in play or disputed because it seems so evident. Why is that? Well, why is that?
And then the only way that it was raised in the summary judgment context was through the affidavit of Mr. Ortiz, which the court rejected, right?
Well, district court struck parts of Mr. Ortiz's declaration. That's true. But
that part.
Yes, that's true.
The relevant part.
Well, no, I disagree because he was not a claim construction expert. Is legal argument. This is the first part of the infringement test. We presented that in our papers.
I don't understand your answer to Judge O'Malley's question. Were the portions of his declaration that were struck relevant or not relevant to what you're arguing?
It's relevant to the second part, whether or not the accused instrumentalities meet this limitation. Yeah. He was not submitted as a claim construction expert. I think that's an important fact.
Can I ask you I'm going to change the topic a little bit. The infringement trial was just about the resilient restoring forces providing a restment holding the reflector element. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you try to explain to me what your non-infringement position was on that question?
Yeah. And this was in Mr. Ortiz's declaration, too. Struck parts of Mr. Ortiz's declaration, but one part, and at trial, was the limitation in Claim 1 that the resilient restoring forces provide, there's other words, I can read it, provide the arrestment. We don't do that. We don't rely on those frictional forces to provide the arrestment. We propose that construction to the district court, adopted our proposed.
How is it that you don't rely on? I'm trying to picture this. So I mean, one, you have the I don't know, I forget what it's called, the stretcher or something coming down from the umbrella. So we have the umbrella that's out horizontally, right? And you have the stretcher coming down, attaching either to the annulus. And then that annulus is either moving all by itself along a pipe and bumping into the bearing member, right? So it's like in the patent. Yours has a bearing member essentially like a tube of some sort, and the thing is coming, and there's a little ring inside here, so it bumps into this, right?
Right.
So in what way is that in any way different from something that, as I say, is an arrestment that prevents the resilient forces from moving?
No. The claim, though, requires the resilient restoring forces provide the arrestment. As Mr. Ortiz testified, in the accused instrument.
So the restoring forces are they not the essentially the vertical forces from the umbrella pushing down on the stretcher?
Yes on those.
So it doesn't really matter whether you block it this way or whether you block it this way.
I agree under the claim. So but we don't do that because the resilient restoring forces, if you see, don't provide the arrestment. What we do, as Mr. Ortiz testified at trial, hits that tube. That's the only arrestment that's provided. Why is that? Because of the advancement. Our structure doesn't, our device doesn't do what's in the patent because it'll sit there and just flow along backwards and forward. If there was no tube back there, it would go flying out the back end.
Right, but there is.
Right. It provides the arrestment, not the resilient restoring force. That's different than what's required.
But you proposed the construction.
Exactly.
The court accepted all the constructions, and you go to the jury, and the jury finds infringement under your construction. It's the best possible world that a defendant could be in, and the jury still found infringement.
Yes.
And so you'd have to argue that there was no substantial evidence to support that conclusion.
Well, there's some other issues, though, too, about Mr. Kritchever's new slide that came in. We raised that in a brief. We discussed that. There was nothing other than...
Yeah, but the trial court carefully went through that and said there's nothing in the slides that is inconsistent with his report. The slides may not have been a part of his report, but experts use demonstrative aids at trial all the time. The court said those didn't even go to the jury. They were demonstrative aids. I don't understand. I mean, when I read the brief and you saying this is the absolute worst thing that the trial court did, and yet it seemed to me the most easy one to conclude that the trial court had the discretion to allow that in.
Abused his discretion, Your Honor, in our opinion. It just flies in the face of Rule 26. It has to be, Rule 26 requires a complete statement of all opinions, the facts or data.
You don't point to any new opinion that was in those slides. You just say the slides weren't in the report in that fashion. The trial court specifically said there's no new opinion, and you don't point to any new opinion in your brief.
Oh, but it's Rule 26. Requires more than just a statement of the opinions, Your Honor. It requires any exhibits used to demonstrate that opinion.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. No. Rule 26 says that you have to have the things that you relied upon, but it doesn't say that if you're going to use a demonstrative aid in front of the jury that you have to put it in your report.
Well, we disagree, Your Honor, because those were the basis. Other than those slides, which we got the night before his testimony at trial, if he wants to stick with what's in his report and give the conclusion, we're happy with that. The reason is we were given the opportunity to cross-examine him on those slides. If he had seen those slides, maybe we would have gotten our own expert. Maybe we would have deposed him. We didn't depose him.
What was in the slides that was a new opinion?
His explanation in a series of 24, almost like a short little snippet of video, how the sliding means supposedly operate. He showed, if you flip through it, it's almost like a movie.
So it's a nicer way of showing it to the jury. But is there any, you didn't argue below, and you haven't argued here, that there was an actual new opinion about how the sliding means operated.
Well, I disagree, though, Your Honor, because that...
So tell me where you argued, either below or here, that it was actually a new opinion versus just a fancier way to describe his opinion.
Well, not necessarily a new opinion, but not requirement of Rule 26. It should have been included in his expert report. So we could have cross-examined him. So we could have called our own expert.
You answered Judge O'Malley's question about how we can transcend the substantial evidence standard with regard to a jury verdict. Agreed. Is because of this evidentiary thing. So if we disagree with you on that point, where are we in terms of overturning the jury verdict on substantial evidence?
Well, what never got to the jury is our point, Your Honor, is the requirement that the sliding means being displaceable on the tubular carrying means. The district court erred in its claim instruction, and it was considered by the district court. On the reply in the summary judgment, Reese's expert came in and gave his opinion on reply of what that term means. And from the district court's summary judgment decision, apparently agreed with Mr. Critchever. But that's not consistent with the intrinsic evidence. That's how there's no infringement, is that limitation. And why is that? Because the intrinsic evidence. On appears two other times in
claim
one.
We really have to agree with you on your claim construction argument, both that it wasn't waived and B, that you're correct on the merits before you could win on the infringement question.
No, I agree. Yeah, that's true.
Your time is running out, and I want to talk to you about the jury instruction. Assume with me for purposes of this question that the jury instruction about personal liability of Ortiz and whoever the other fellow is plain error, that it is also – there isn't even an argument that it's non-prejudicial in the usual sense, namely that the evidence would have required a finding of personal liability even if there had been a correct instruction. Those arguments, I think, are not even made. But there is – and the district court didn't disagree with either of those two propositions. The district court said, and this is what Breezy says here, it just doesn't matter here because the partnership was held liable, and as partners, the individuals are liable for the partnership's liability. Now, I can imagine ways in which there would be a difference in consequence, but I'm just imagining them. Tell me what difference in consequence there actually is according to whether the individuals are subject to a personal liability judgment in this case and the situation where they're not.
They're not because of the standard for the erroneous jury instruction. It has to be both erroneous and prejudicial. Remember, the prejudicial standard is very easy to meet. Could not have changed the result.
I'm assuming that. The district court also assumed that. The district court nevertheless said there's no challenge to B2 Pro, I guess, the partnership's liability, and when the partnership is liable, the partners are responsible for that liability. So there is no, say under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 61, there is no essentially harmful error to correct.
No, we disagree. Because
tell me what the concrete difference is.
That presumes that the jury found that the partnership acted through these other individuals. That presumes that.
You did not argue here that the partnership's liability is indirectly affected by the erroneous instruction about the individual's liability.
You brought this up in response to arguments raised in the response.
You did not argue here that the partnership's liability
is improper.
No,
I agree with that. But it's trying to transmit that to the individuals, I think, where the prejudicial standard comes into play. That presumes that B2 Pro was found to be an infringer because of some conduct by somebody. I mean, it's an entity. It obviously works through people.
We have to assume that.
It could work through anybody. It doesn't have to be those two individuals.
But acts through its partnerships. The jury could have found that individuals, the other workers, were not acts of the partnership. Could have found that. And therefore, the only way B2 Pro was a direct infringer was through Langton and Ortiz. And the jury found Langton and Ortiz infringed using that wrong jury instruction that direct infringement could include inducement. That's why, Your Honor. Everybody presumes that B2 Pro acts through whoever they want to. Whatever worker does infringement.
What is the relationship between Key Lighting and B2 Pro? I mean, there was a lot of cute testimony here. It looked like Key Lighting didn't even pay its proper dues to, say, an active corporation. And so, I mean, the fact that there was some reference to it being a corporation seemed to be just a fiction.
Well, it wasn't. The testimony from Mr. Ortiz was that it is a valid corporation. All dues are paid up.
He didn't say it was a valid corporation at the time of the acts alleged. What he said is, well, there were lots of times when it wasn't a valid corporation, and then other times we make it go ahead and pay, and it becomes valid again, and then it becomes invalid again. And that's the best he ever said about its status.
But
he never said it was an active corporation.
But he did say it is a Nevada corporation, and all at the time of the testimony, all dues have been paid up. It is, they are very poor record keepers. Yes, Mr. Langton signed something to the state of New York. They're bad record keepers, but Key Lighting, Inc. is a corporation, Nevada corporation, and although the jury found B2Pro as a partnership, it is, according to Mr. Langton, Mr. Keith, a DBA.
But they also said they're two separate corporations.
In some of the documents.
Separate business.
Yes.
And that B2Pro was the one doing the work and sometimes just used the name Key Light.
But again, they're not attorneys. They're people who do, like Mr. Ortiz, 15 years in the lighting business, and Mr. Langton also, years in the lighting business.
Can I go back to, we'll extend your time because I think we've got a few more questions. Just to make sure I understand where you concluded with Judge Toronto and your discussion with him, your view is that the relevance of the jury instruction and the reason it hurt you is because the jury might have relied exclusively on that portion of the jury instruction to find liability by the partnership, B2.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you haven't appealed the finding of liability by B2, have you? Is that the part of this appeal?
We appealed the final judgment, if that's specifically...
have you raised here the fact that B2 as a corporation should not have been liable?
No.
So how is that argument preserved here on appeal? I mean, the argument that you're saying that, well, the reason it's relevant is because B2, we should assume that the jury wouldn't have found B2 liable and therefore we're only left with these two partners when that issue is settled and done for purposes of our appeal, that B2 as a partnership is liable.
Because
you see my question?
I understand. It goes to the individuals. I was arguing that the two individuals, Langton or Keith, could not, because the argument was raised by Brisa, well, B2 Pro is an infringer, therefore they must be infringers also.
Right.
But my argument is, that's not necessarily true. The jury could have found that Langton or Keith were direct infringers using the incorrect jury.
And the consequence of that would be everything would fall then if the jury instruction were incorrect. But you haven't appealed the finding of liability by the jury of the partnership. So it seems to me that that door is closed in terms of doing anything about that. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're wrong, Your Honor. I think the issue needs to be addressed also because of the claim construction issue. If you agree with my claim construction.
Well, yeah, okay. I appreciate that. Yeah. If we're back there. Let me just spend a couple more minutes and I ask your indulgence just on jury instruction number 18. And that's the willfulness question. You did not object to the jury instruction. Am I correct about that?
At the time, we did on the record, as we note in our brief, we raised an objection after the jury. But there was a time lag. But as I said in the blue brief, we did object. I can find the site in the blue brief.
But you concede there was no timely objection to the instruction.
Not necessarily, because we raised it with Judge Conte. That we want to get in after, other evidence of other claim instructions we had proposed because it's not going to the jury. I'm paraphrasing what we said. And Judge Conte said, denied objection, those for the record. We felt we preserved our objection. It's not that the jury instruction was wrong. It probably does state the right law under Seagate. The problem is Judge Conte didn't decide the objective factor. And this is similar to the recent Stryker versus Zimmer case.
So why are you arguing on appeal the jury instruction here? You didn't file a JMAL just on the issue of willfulness, the failure to find objective reasonableness, the failure for the judge. That none of that stuff came up other than, as I understand it, other than an objective to the jury instruction. Am I right about that?
Well, you're partially right. We did file a new motion for new trial. It included the erroneous jury instruction.
Yeah, but I'm saying outside, you conceded to us that there was nothing in and of itself in the jury instruction.
Right.
The real failure here, the alleged failure, was that the judge, as a practical matter, either before or after it went to the jury, didn't himself analyze the objective reasonableness. Where is that argument preserved?
We raised an objection. We feel it was in the record, not at the time the jury instruction was objection to, but during right before the trial. I can find it in the transcript. It's in the transcript.
Before the trial, you said. Well, I don't want to take your time here, but even whatever you – oh, go ahead.
Opening brief, page 32. It cites the transcript. Sorry, the A315. I'll just read it.
I'm sorry, A315.
315, line 24.
Okay.
Their defense advises – I'm just paraphrasing – the district court at trial that evidence may come in on the issue of whether defendants acted in a particularly reasonable manner.
Are you sure we're on A315?
315, line 24.
That said, we just want to bring to the court's attention.
I believe that's
right. There's an issue in this case.
And the next page goes.
All right. And how? And so this was your objection, and how did you preserve it? You mentioned that you asked for a new trial.
Yes.
But your request only had to do with your belief that you had infringement theories that you should have been allowed to present.
Absolutely. The first objective factor is determinative of a willfulness issue. We propose constructions that, first of all, the sliding means being displaceable on the tubular carry means.
Right, but you never argued that the fact that the judge allowed the jury to make some conclusions with respect to the objective prong was itself error.
I think we did in the new trial. This is similar to Stryker versus Zimmer. I mean, this is a case actually worse than Stryker versus Zimmer, the recent back last month, where in that case the district court apparently after the trial did decide the objective factor, but didn't give enough weight. Here, Judge Conte gave it to the jury.
Well, as I understand Chief Judge Prost's question, or maybe in any event, it's my question. Where did you ask the judge, himself or herself, to decide whether your non-infringement defenses were objectively reasonable?
And one in the objection I noted in the transcript. And then the new trial. We asked for a new trial based on that, based on the willfulness issue. And otherwise, I mean, there are other pleadings before that. I mean, in the trial brief, we filed the trial brief with Judge Conte. On the summary judgment motion, the motion was summary judgment for willful infringement.
And in the new trial motion, arguing that your non-infringement defense was objectively reasonable and therefore there cannot be willfulness, did you rely on the single infringement issue that went to trial or only on elements found against you on summary judgment?
I'd have to look at it just to be sure on that, but we must have raised all those issues. I just don't have it in front of me right now.
How much money did the other side ask for the jury to award?
That varied it. The patent infringement was, I believe, $2.4 million. For the trade dress claim, which we prevailed on, it was zero. But although they had argued they should get the $2.4 million also. But it was.
But on the patent claim, they asked for $2.4 and they got $300.
Correct.
All right. We've gone way ahead. We'll restore your 2 minutes of rebuttal, and we'll add 8 minutes to the other side, although we're all hopeful that you won't need to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Gary Servant for Brise Electrotechnik and Hans Werner and Brise, Collective Brise. May it please the Court. I wanted to respond to several arguments that were raised this morning. I wanted to start first with the claim construction issue. The term here is sliding mean displaceable on the tubular carrying means. The parties agreed to the construction of the term, and the court adopted that construction. The defendants or the appellants here never requested during Markman hearings, during claim construction hearings, that the word, the phrase displaceable on should be construed something different than what they already agreed to. The, what they're trying to do now is take the construction of word on in claim two, where the phrase is supported on. The agreed construction there was abutting and engaging. There was nothing about contact. They're trying to take that phrase, collapse it into the definition of contact, inject a new term in here, collapse that term into on, and port it into claim one to a term displaceable on.
Can I, yes. Can I change the subject quite radically to the things that at least cause me some concern? The jury instruction about the individual's liability. Yes. The district court did not say, and you do not argue, that that was a correct instruction. And the district court did not find, and you do not argue, that it was non-prejudicial in the usual sense, that the evidence was so strong that not only could a jury find individual liability under proper instruction, but it had to. The district court found, and you argue only as to that, that it simply does not make any difference whether there is a judgment of personal liability or simply indirect responsibility for the personal liability that attaches to the partnership. If that's the case, tell me why you would not give up the personal liability judgment against the individuals.
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple of issues here. So the first part is that the only issue they're taking with the instruction number 14 is the second sentence that dealt with personal liability of corporate officers. It does not affect corporate liability of Key Lighting.
My question was not about that. They do not argue liability against liability of Key Lighting or against B2 Pro. I want to know, why is it that you would not stand here and say we will give up the personal liability of the individuals?
Well, we can give up the personal liability of
the personal liability judgment.
We can give up the part of the instruction that awarded personal liability as officers because they are partners in the partnership B2 Pro, which was found to be partnership, which they didn't object. And the partnership of what is directly infringing the patent. They're liable personally as partners of partnership B2 Pro.
That does not itself support a judgment of personal liability against them here. You might go after them for personal liability for the partnership's liabilities. Are you willing here to say that you will give up the judgment of personal liability for the individuals? And if not, it must matter to you, in which case, how can we possibly
affirm? Well, Your Honor, there was also a judgment of personal infringement by Langton and Ortiz separately from instruction number 14.
How do we know that's separate from the instruction? The instruction, that may have been, in fact, the sole basis on which the jury held them personally liable.
Well, they held them personally liable as officers, whereas the instruction number, the other parts of the jury instructions were basically saying that the individual are personally infringing. So there's a difference between infringement under corporation, infringement by B2 Pro's partnership, and infringement by them as individual, as opposed to personal liability for the acts of the corporation.
Okay, let me put all that aside, which appears nowhere in your red brief. Can you answer straight up, are you willing, standing here, to give up the personal liability judgment against Langlands and Ortiz?
We're not ready to.
Why not?
Because the personal liability flows from their partnership as B2 Pro.
The personal liability judgment does not flow from the partnership liability. And there certainly was no instruction that they can be held liable solely as responsible for the partnership liability.
Well, actually,
why does it matter to you that there is a personal liability judgment against Langland and Ortiz?
Well, I think it is a moot point because they are partners of B2 Pro.
So why don't you give it up if it's a moot point?
I think that at this point, I mean, to the extent that it would help them avoid liability, I don't know. I have to look at all the different issues associated. They're able to avoid liability.
Which is to say there is some possibility it actually matters.
No, I don't think it matters, Your Honor.
You think B2Pro is judgment proof? Is that what you're concerned about?
It's very possible B2Pro is judgment proof. It's very possible key lighting is judgment proof. And as you've seen in the record, there was a lot of discovery issues and sanctions for non-production, and we had very difficult time tracking things down, including financials, documents. So I think...
But my problem is that the possibilities that it might matter are the very possibilities that seem to me to make the reasoning, if they're real, to make the reasoning, the sole reasoning on which you defend and the district court found that you may as well leave them in place, notwithstanding the plain, possibly prejudicial error of the instruction, it seems to me to erase that it might actually matter.
I grant you, Your Honor, I do not believe it matters. But it just given the posture of this case and the history of this case, I think that the instruction number 14 is not prejudicial to them, and therefore...
Isn't it true that the district court also, separately from this discussion of the partnership liability, said that there was, and I think the words were there was abundant evidence of their personal liability, and you had separately brought claims against them in their personal capacity?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's what I'm trying to get to, that we brought claims...
Your red brief does not argue that the evidence is so strong, whatever abundant means, so strong that a correctly instructed jury would have had to find them liable.
No,
it does not argue that. It merely says there's sufficient evidence so that there is not a JMOL entitlement of non-infringement on their part.
Correct, Your Honor. But the jury found them personally infringing, not necessarily personally liable.
And
they
it
found
might have been based
infringing.
On that instruction.
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. It might have.
No, the instruction number 14, the second sentence says personal liability as officers because of corporate infringement, not because of their individual infringement. The jury had enough evidence to find them individually infringing and therefore awarded liability for their individual infringement. So while we're happy to take their personal liability corporate officers out of the case, keep key lighting infringement in, keep B2Pro infringement in, they would still be liable as partners of B2Pro, personally, for B2Pro direct infringement, whether it was done by them individually or by anyone else at B2Pro, as long as B2Pro infringes, and they're the sole two partners,
yeah,
they're jointly separate.
Point. We've come full circle now, because that's why if that's the position and the liability finding for the judgment holds for B2, then as you suggested, it was moot, as Judge Toronto suggested, then why don't you agree to take it out?
Okay.
And we're at a, you know, we're
I, at the same I understand. I understand the point. We would agree, Your Honor, if that is the pass that you know how the court is viewing it. We originally viewed it as that there is no imputation, there was no instruction that somehow the liability of individuals somehow transferred into direct infringement by B2Pro. There was no instruction for the jury to find that. The jury found B2Pro directly infringing and therefore they're liable. But given your questions and your explanation, I think we're ready to.
Can I ask you?
You're willing to? I'm sorry. Just
we're willing to concede that part. Doesn't matter, and we would not care about the personal liability as long as B2Pro is found liable and their direct infringement, they're liable as corporate, as partners of B2Pro, and as long as Key Lighting is held liable for its direct infringement.
Can I switch to willfulness?
Yes.
Can you explain, first of all, put completely to one side whether it matters that the jury was asked to address the objective reasonableness portion of Seagate.
Yes.
The district judge didn't discuss that, didn't say, here's why their non-infringement defense was objectively reasonable. So I guess I have two questions. One, did they ask the judge to decide that? I don't think you say not in your red brief. And second, explain why their non-infringement position is objectively unreasonable.
Okay. So the judge, Judge Conte, in the motion for new trial, stated that their positions were not reasonable. He wasn't going to overturn the verdict because the claim constructions on which they found to be infringing were the exact claim construction that they proposed. So he's basically saying the claim construction didn't go to the jury. The claim construction were reviewed by him. He understood the claim construction. And he says that based on your claim construction, you were found to be infringing. That takes care of the objective problem because he didn't...
I'm sorry. How could that possibly take care of the objective prong unless you're standing here and saying that every loser has made, by definition, an objectively unreasonable argument?
No, the claim construction itself was something that they presented.
Right. So what
There was no dispute on claim construction that somehow the claim construction...
So why wasn't... I guess what I'm interested in is the explanation for why taking the claim constructions as a given, their non-infringement defense was not objectively reasonable. Wrong, evidently, but objectively reasonable.
Okay, so from the non-infringement defense, which went to the jury on one term, was based on their claim construction and their structure and operation of their device. Every part of their accused device, the claim one read on every part of their accused device. So the jury was asked to whether their defense of non-infringement, which is a factual matter, was objectively reasonable. And
that is a matter of law, and I'm still waiting for the explanation for why it was objectively unreasonable in your view, taking as a premise that it was incorrect, that the jury could properly say, no, you're wrong. It actually this element, the whatever this resilient restoring forces element, the only issue that actually went to the jury, that actually does read on your product. Why was it unreasonable objectively for them to argue the contrary?
Well, because under the Mayer case, the question when the defense is based on the legal issues, then the court should be deciding. It's a question of law. When the objectable prong is based on the factual, the defense of that is based on the factual issue, under the Mayer case, it can be decided by the jury.
And I'm trying to remember Seagate. I mean, we've got the subjective prong and the objective prong.
Right.
And you're saying that under the objective prong, we've bifurcated and we've said claim construction is for the court and infringement questions are for the jury? Is that
in the Mayer?
What about validity? Because those questions are part fact and part law.
So under the Mayer, in the Mayer case.
You say the Mayer case. Are you talking about Seagate and race?
No. It's actually Mayer.
We actually said it in FAR, did we not? That as to the objective prong, underlying facts.
Correct.
Are to be decided by the jury.
Correct.
And then only the legal implication of those facts ultimately is what the court decides. And that's where the court here said the only legal implication is whether or not the claim construction was right or wrong because every other determination was a question of fact.
Correct. And in this particular case, Judge Conte looked at the legal, what the jury found based on factual issues. They found it to be infringing, looked at how the case progressed given that the infringement was based on the claim construction that they proposed and they agreed. So he felt the objective prong, he didn't want to overturn.
The only thing they argued that made their defenses objectively reasonable is that they had this one other displaceable on claim construction and a piece of evidence that the judge had excluded. That those were the things that made it reasonable, and he said that those are the only legal questions, and legally they have no leg to stand on. So as a result, the jury's determination as to the factual elements is consistent with Barb, right?
That's correct. They never argued, they waived their arguments on claim construction during the Markman hearing and your pre-trial. So their claim constructions are when their argument on claim construction, not only is it wrong, but it wasn't even in the case. What the claim construction that were presented and that are in the case are the claim construction that they agreed to, and under those construction, they infringe. What they're trying to do now is rework the claim construction back into them and say, okay, our claim constructions are not infringing, and therefore the objective prong is not met, but they never presented it.
On 822, which is where the district court is discussing the attorney's fees section, which I'm sure you want to get to here, but in passing, the district court judge in rejecting the attorney's fees says, moreover, some of the positions advanced to trial by defendants had merit. Do we know what he was talking about there?
Well, I think that when they're talking about the positions, they were talking about possibly damages. There was a discussion of what actually is happening with respect to the forces. How is their device structured? Because on summary judgment motion, Judge Swain was asked to decide all the elements. The problem with this last element where resilient restorative forces come in is that it's hard to visualize on papers. So that's why she decided that it should be brought to the jury. So during the trial, there was demonstration of what the umbrella is, and the jury had the ability to see it, which is something that the district court judge didn't have in front of her when she was ruling on summary judgment.
Can you explain, please, why the position that they took about the resilient forces at trial is not just wrong, but objectively unreasonable?
Okay. I can, Your Honor.
At A271, this is the patent itself. Column 4, line 17 through 25. This passage refers to the umbrella reflector shown in figure one on page 269 of the A269 of the patent. And what it discusses is the idea that when you open the umbrella and it passes the plane, what I call dead center plane, and it goes past that point, the forces of the umbrella push the stretchers in. And once they're pushed in, you can't open the umbrella. There's a force now you have to overcome to close it. So once you open it, it sits there open. Now you have to overcome to close it. If you look at the passage in the patent, it says that the stretchers are dimensioned in such a way that you can get to that point, because if the stretchers are too long, you'll stop before the dead center. If the stretchers are short enough, you'll get right through it. And it says I'm going to read through the patent, that besides, the construction is dimensioned such that sliding means can be slightly moved beyond this position corresponding to the dead center of the articulated levers toward the bearing body so as to engage the latter. As a result of the restoring forces, the forces are coming that are pushing the sliding means, and the impact of the bearing body, the sliding means is reliably retained in this position shows, which is the open position. And that's exactly what this claim term is talking about. Now, this description refers to figure one. That's exactly the structure that they have, except that they're arguing, and they were arguing in the district court, that somehow you have to ignore this passage and the fact that it's the sliding means, it's touching the bearing body, somehow it creates a non-infringement argument. But the passage explains that the resilient restorative forces pressing against the bearing body retain the sliding means in that position, so when you have to open it, close the umbrella, you have to overcome them. That's all the claim one element requires, and that's exactly what they had. So the issue was, what is the resilient restorative forces?
And they had an argument about essentially not the bearing body doing the blocking, but something else. And I think your point is it really doesn't matter because the claim is just about something stopping the restoring forces.
That's correct.
It doesn't
correct.
Matter what stops it.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, what they had is they had what we would call the bearing body. They had a structure. They had another structure fitted into it to extend slightly past the tip. So whether you go slightly below the tip or you go up to it, it doesn't matter, because eventually that whatever that structure is, that becomes the bearing body, and you're touching against it. their position on non-infringement was unreasonable. It was difficult to see on summary judgment because, again, we're talking about forces and it's hard to visualize.
Appreciate the difficulty.
But that's really what the trial was about, showing what's in the umbrella, how the forces are acting, and what's in their device. Mr. Kritchever, the expert for Breezy, actually pointed to infringement by looking at their device. He didn't do it by pointing to the slides, by pointing to the demonstrative. The demonstrative basically showing what is happening in the umbrella, exactly what I just described. That was in his expert report. That was in his claim charts. He's basically showing the jury, this is how you open the umbrella. This is how the sliding means, or the body slides along the tube. This is what happens when you get to the point of zero dead center, and this is what happens when you go slightly past it. That's in the patent. It's in Figure 1. It's in their product. They never argue that the product doesn't have that structure.
Let me tell you, we're already way beyond time. You want to take, like, really a very minute to discuss your cross-appeal, or we can rest on
yes.
the briefs if that's okay.
Your Honor, there are three elements why we believe that the Judge Conte decision on the attorney's fees was error of law. Number one, he applied the wrong legal standard for exceptional case under the Octane standard.
But he says that at the beginning. He sets forth what was the standard at the time, correctly what was the standard at the time, and no longer applies. But his analysis seems to be in line with Octane, does it not? I mean, he talked about the totality of the circumstances, and his analysis itself seems to me not that out of line with what he would do if he had Octane before him now. Right?
Your Honor, he was focusing on sanctionable conduct. There was a litany of non-sanctionable conduct, or litigation misconduct, for which defendants were not sanctioned. And if I can just cite to some of the
well, if it's in your brief, I don't know that you want to take the time.
Well, there were two motions, even one motion to compel, which defendant filed, in which Judge Dallinger said that these arguments were disingenuous, are baseless, and lack merit. This was part of their motion to compel, which it had five or six elements in there. On one element, it says, your arguments are so far off base that I find them disingenuous. And that was one motion. There was another motion where they argued that somehow plaintiffs were precluded from taking further discovery. They thought that they had the ability to have discovery, and it was extended to both them and the plaintiffs, where it was the order that Judge Dallinger issued was clear that because of their misconduct, plaintiff discovery was going to be extended by 30 days, not theirs. They argued in front of Judge Dallinger that wasn't the case, they misunderstood it, and he chastised them for it. He said, your arguments here are completely false. And this is part of, he actually
and
called
did
it.
Did you ask for sanctions?
We didn't ask for sanctions. We basically, this was part of when they didn't produce financial documents. He admitted the financial documents and it was part of the argument. So
what you're saying is, even if you buy the proposition that once sanctions and some attorney's fees were already shifted,
correct,
that to the extent that there was other misconduct where there was no earlier shifting of attorney's fees, that they could support an award of attorney's fees.
That's correct, Your Honor. There were we actually told the court that we're not looking for compensation for the conduct that was sanctioned. We're looking for the attorney's fees minus whatever we already compensated. And the elements where Judge Dallinger didn't sanction them, but found their conduct to be unreasonable, if I can just cite to A-121, A-119, meritless, entirely disingenuous arguments, A-121, defendant's omission is blatant, misleading, and unprofessional. This was not conduct that was sanctioned because it was part of their motion. And he actually, in one of the motions that Judge Dallinger, or one of the orders that Judge Dallinger issued, he actually said that some of this can come up to a threshold of Rule 11 if it was to be pursued, but he didn't go any further. And plaintiffs didn't pursue Rule 11 motion. But in addition to the sanctions that Judge Conte was looking at, there was enough unreasonable conduct for which they were not sanctioned that didn't come into consideration at the court, you know, by Judge Conte.
All right. Well, we'll restore a minute for rebuttal, and we've already restored some of your time. We'll give you four minutes to respond.
First of all, on the willfulness issue, my friend cites passages not from the claim. One, it was from the specification, leaves out the last sentence. Column 4, line 15, line 25, says, in that particular embodiment, any particular clamping or resting means are not required. That's different than what's in Claim 1. Claim 1 requires that the resilient restoring forces do provide an arrestment. Our position was objectively reasonable based on the claim construction by Judge Swain. She adopted our claim construction where that particular limitation, resilient restoring forces provide an arrestment, as shown in Figure 1, that's in her claim construction order. Figure 1 shows a gap. Figure 1 shows a gap. It doesn't show what's in that passage quoted from the specification, the written description. That's not the claim. The claim is what's in play here. Mr. Ortiz defended and gave very good analysis as to why there was no infringement based on what the one limitation was at trial. It's important to note that there's some efforts by the plaintiff, Risa, that the bearing body can be anything you want. It can be a bearing body, it can be 2 feet out this way or 2 feet out the other way. It can be anything. But it's not. Claim doesn't allow that. What does the claim say? The bearing body is a particular item, and it has to have a ring of articulated joints. The claim requires the articulated joints to be on the bearing body. So here you have your bearing body. Here comes the joints from the stretchers. All of a sudden, at some point, another piece is not the bearing body. If it's out here, if the joints are appended on the bearing body, a tube which doesn't contact the joints is not the bearing body. And so Mr. Ortiz did present a valid and good defense to infringement. And we know that. One reason is Judge Swain denied the summary judgment of infringement based on that limitation, that there was a disputed fact issue. Now, on the cross appeal, I think it's important to note the facts. We did produce the 180 umbrella. Time and again, there's a reference.
Most of it.
The umbrella, the parts, what we had. Right. The parts, other parts, we didn't have.
But it is true that Judge Dollinger, even the order where you were sanctioned, he pointed out unprofessional and improper conduct, both on your part personally and on the part of your client, in multiple places where he said, but I'm not going to rely on those things here for sanctions. They might provide a basis for Rule 11 sanctions later, or they might provide some ability to make credibility determinations later, but I'm not going to rely on those things. They're out there. I find them all improper conduct, but I'm not going to sanction those. Shouldn't the court have considered those things along with the other times where they found your position to be disingenuous and essentially virtually false? Shouldn't the court have considered those things in determining whether to award fees?
I think he did. First of all, many of those statements are based on the erroneous assumption that we didn't produce the umbrella, the 180 umbrella. Of course, we did. It's also based on the fact that we hadn't produced responsive documents.
Well, that ship is
there. We had.
Four judges said you didn't. Everybody to have considered this in this case so far made the factual finding that you didn't properly produce and even thanked you for that. You haven't appealed that determination.
But we did file an opposition that showed that it was erroneous. Remember, this came up on the reply originally. We didn't have the opportunity to respond to that reply. And when we did, in the opposition filed January 2011, we explained that the reply was wrong. We did produce responsive documents. It was filed 14 days after his order in January. And then we appealed his later order issuing monetary
sanctions. You did not appeal any of the sanctions awards. any of the findings with respect, at least with respect to the underlying discovery violations. How can you argue now to us that you didn't commit the very discovery violations that several judges, magistrate judges and district judges, found that you committed?
Well, because it came up on the reply argument, which we never had an opportunity to respond to. And when we did respond in January, we showed with facts why documents were produced. And so that's why, Your Honor, we were never given the opportunity. And when we did file our opposition in January, 14 days after the order, we explained that responsive documents had been produced. That's important to note. District court order said produce the prior art umbrella. That's all we had, the umbrella. We produced that. We didn't have the tubes, the lights. We didn't have that. So we produced the umbrella. That's what the district court order says, 8 through 22. We did produce responsive documents. That came up on the reply argument. We fundamentally at least are able to respond to that reply argument. And when we did, the magistrate judge apparently overlooked it. We raised it again after he issued the monetary sanctions with the district court and explained that we had produced the documents. District court overlooked that also. We think that was error. Now, on the cross appeal, it's important to note.
One final thought. Yeah. Way beyond our time.
Defendant Ortiz factually incredibly challenged Brees' case, both on summary judgment. In his declaration, he demonstrated factually. Now, although the district court struck part of his declaration, he demonstrated in that declaration there was no infringement. He also demonstrated no infringement at trial, in his trial testimony. Now, we got to relate to what we were faced with. We took a 30B6 deposition of Brees, Mr. Brees, to ask him the basis for the infringement contention. This is in our brief. We asked him, what's the basis for the sale contention? He couldn't answer. This was during discovery. And we took his deposition in October 2010. Of course we thought discovery was extended through October. We were taking depositions, as ordered by the magistrate judge, in October 2010. It would make sense that discovery would be extended for both parties. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We have the argument. We've got a minute left to respond to the brief.
Your Honor, just quickly, with respect to this new argument about umbrella not being a reflector, that the judge didn't know what he
was... Well, wait a minute. That's not dealing with the cross-appeal. You get rebuttal time on the cross-appeal, so let's limit it to that, please.
Okay. On the cross-appeal, we believe that the judge didn't apply the right legal principle for exceptional case, did not you look at all of the conduct that was unreasonable, only limited to sanctionable. In other words, did not look at the totality of the circumstances. And under this scenario, the district court's decision should be reversed. The court should find exceptional case, or at least remand for further consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel. The case is submitted. We're going to take a brief recess now.